cameras have finally revealed her open grave. Fiction has become fact. Pitt's description of her in the story pretty well matches what the robot cameras recorded shortly after she was found through the miracle of side-scan sonar. Aside from her structural damage, sustained during her 13,000-foot plunge to the bottom, she suffers little from sea growth and corrosion. Even the wine bottles and silver service that spilled out on the silt appear pristine. Will the Titanic ever be raised? It is unlikely. A total salvage operation would nearly equal the cost of the Apollo Man on the Moon project. Soon, however, we can expect to see manned submersibles circling her hulk in search of her treasure and artifacts, while teams of American and British attorneys roll up their sleeves for long courtroom battles over her possession. Pitt has always looked into the future and found it full of excitement and adventure. In the 1970s, he was a man of the 80s. Now he is a man of the 90s. Like a scout out for a wagon train, Pitt looks over the next hill and tells us what's there. He sees what we'd all like to see in our imaginations. That's why no one could have been more delighted than me when it was announced that the Titanic had been found. I knew that Pitt had seen her first. Clive Cussler. April 1912. Prelude. The man on deck A, stateroom 33, tossed and turned in his narrow berth, the mind behind his sweating face lost in the depths of a nightmare. He was small, no more than 2 inches over 5 feet, with thinning white hair and a bland face, whose only imposing feature was a pair of dark, bushy eyebrows. His hands lay entwined on his chest, his fingers twitching in a nervous rhythm. He looked to be in his 50s. His skin had the color and texture of a concrete sidewalk, and the lines under his eyes were deeply etched. Yet he was only 10 days shy of his 34th birthday. The physical grind and the mental torment of the last 5 months had exhausted him to the ragged edge of madness. During his waking hours, he found his mind wandering down vacant channels, losing all track of time and reality. He had to remind himself continually where he was and what day it was. He was going mad, slowly but irrevocably mad. And the worst part of it was that he knew he was going mad. His eyes fluttered open and he focused them on the silent fan that hung from the ceiling of his stateroom. His hands traveled over his face and felt the 2-week growth of beard. He didn't have to look at his clothes. He knew they were soiled and rumpled and stained with nervous sweat. He should have bathed and changed after he'd boarded the ship, but instead he'd taken to his berth and slept a fearful, obsessed sleep, off and on, for nearly 3 days. It was late into Sunday evening, and the ship wasn't due to dock in New York until early Wednesday morning, slightly more than 50 hours hence. He tried to tell himself he was safe now, but his mind refused to accept it, in spite of the fact that the prize that had cost so many lives was absolutely secure. For the 100th time, he felt the lump in his vest pocket. Satisfied that the key was still there, he rubbed a hand over his glistening forehead and closed his eyes once more. He wasn't sure how long he'd dozed. Something had jolted him awake. Not a loud sound or a violent movement. It was more like a trembling motion from his mattress, and a strange grinding noise somewhere far below his starboard stateroom. He rose stiffly to a sitting position and swung his feet to the floor. A few minutes passed, and he sensed an unusual, vibrationless quiet. Then his befogged mind grasped the reason. The engines had stopped. He sat there listening, but the only sounds came from the soft choking of the stewards in the passageway and the muffled talk from the adjoining cabins. An icy tentacle of uneasiness wrapped around him. Another passenger might have simply ignored the interruption and quickly gone back to sleep, but he was within an inch of a mental breakdown, and his 5 senses were working overtime at magnifying every emotion.